Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together, we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Bain, and once more I'm at Shea Hart with Peter Hart. And today, we haven't had to remember anything today, Pete, so today is Jutland, the race to the north. Now, this is another in our long-running series on Jutland. We're actually stretching this out much longer than the battle.
Definitely. Mm. So where are we up to? Come on.
Well, Hipper, he'd performed his reconnaissance and entrapment role to perfection.
Was that during the run to the south?
And the east and the west. No. He was running all over the shop. Now, throughout the early exchanges, he'd kept Shea admirably, given that he was an admiral, well informed as to events, and had succeeded in enticing a significant section of the Grand Fleet into the moor of the entire High Seas Fleet. Now, Shea's plans were about to reach fruition.
Looked like it. So that you've got the British and German fleets sailing, converging. Converging is a posh word for it. And who were the first British ships to sight the High Seas Fleet? Because, you know, the battlecruisers are fighting, the other battlecruisers, everything's going off. Who first sights the High Seas Fleet?
Well, that's the 2nd Light Cruiser Squadron, who were performing their scouting role some 3 miles ahead of Beatty, Admiral Beatty, Vice Admiral Beatty.
So, first of all, Admiral Beatty, the Admirable Crichton. No, don't confuse everybody. Anyway, they send a sighting report of a German cruiser that they spot. That's about 1630. This isn't just a stray German cruiser, is it? And soon, from the flagship Southampton of the 2nd Light Cruiser Squadron, Commodore William Goodenough sees something. I better tell you what he sees, hadn't I? I'll do that now. We saw ahead of us first smoke, then masts, then ships. "Look, sir," said Arthur Peters, "this is the day of a life cruiser's lifetime. The whole of the High Seas Fleet is before you." It was. 16 battleships with destroyers dispersed around them on each bow. This was reported.
Bow and bow.
Bow.
Now, 1633. Now, obviously, the times are
I think they're up to 7 minutes, 3.5 minutes either way, which is a 7 minute difference.
At 1633-ish, they sent the momentous signal by searchlight. Battleships southeast.
The excitement, I can feel it running through me body like lightning.
And it also ran through the Bridge of the Lion. And it was fast becoming acclimatised to such surprises.
I'll bet they were. Things blowing up all around them.
And this is Flag Captain Alfred Chatfield aboard HMS Lion. "We had no information that German battle fleet was at sea. Rather, had the Admiralty told us that they were still in the Jade River. It was therefore a surprise, yet not a great one, as it was a possibility Beatty always had in mind."
He didn't seem to act like he had it in mind, did he? Now, Beatty, you've got to give him credit. Beatty is not a bad officer.
And he acts immediately, doesn't he?
He's more slapdash than bad. He leaves the 5th Battle Squadron. They're still firing at Hipper's battlecruisers. They carry on to the south. But he turns his battlecruisers to the port and heads directly towards the reported sighting. He believed it, but he wanted to see with his own eyes. So he turns towards the high seas fleet. Now, what's happening ahead of him? What's Goodenough doing? What's he doing?
Well, Goodenough, he also held on towards the German fleet because he believed that it was his duty to amass as much information as possible for his senior officers.
And he's one of the very few officers who act on their responsibility to senior command. Anyway, this is him, Commodore William Goodenough. Or good enough for me. We hang on for a few minutes to make sure before confirming the message. My commander, efficient and cool, said, "If you're going to make that signal, you'd better make it now, sir. You may never make another." Other remarks, some acid, some ribald, were passed. You fucking Well, yeah, I mean, you know, if one shell could almost do for a light cruiser, and they're sailing towards the whole bloody High Seas Fleet.
Now, Beatty didn't have to pursue his southeasterly course for very long.
No.
After just a couple of minutes at 16:40, he sighted the advanced ships of the High Seas Fleet, and instantly his position was transmogrified. Now, there's a word you don't hear every day,
yeah,
Pete.
Yeah, I thought you might not be able to pronounce it. Although, actually, when you said it, I realised that how else would you say it?
No longer the gallant admiral accepting casualties in the pursuit of his weaker prey, now he was the prey.
Oh, Gary, it's so exciting. The situation complained...
Complained?
I'm complaining about this situation, said Beatty. Now, it's completely changed, doesn't it? Beatty, what's his duty now? What is his duty?
Well, to lead the High Seas Fleet under the guns of the Grand Fleet while simultaneously ensuring that he passed as much intelligence as possible to his commander-in-chief, who would assume the sole responsibility for achieving the destruction of the German fleet.
Yeah, well, as we will see, he does part of this.
He does. And Beatty issued a flag signal ordering
his force to
about turn. He timed it almost perfectly, for as the battlecruisers turned, the first shells from the still-distant German dreadnoughts splashed around them.
Splash, splash. Yeah, it's 20,000 yards, range a bit too long for accuracy, and too fleeting an opportunity. They could have got the range, but they didn't have time. It would have been bloody unlucky if one of the battlecruisers had been hit at that stage. So Beatty's luck holds, his ships escape unscathed, and they turn their turrets round to starboard, ready to... Because which way were they pointing before?
The other way.
Port.
Oh, so, thank you very much.
So they'd be ready to re-engage the German battlecruisers, who, of course, would also be turning any time there. Now, during the flight to the north, Goodenough, he continued to send out regular reports to Jellicoe. Unfortunately, there's a problem. What can you imagine that problem being in the time before GPS?
Well, the constant manoeuvring, of course, necessary to evade the German shells rendered their navigational dead reckoning erroneous.
Could you explain navigational dead reckoning for me, Gary?
No. Now, as a result, the reports made by Goodenough were marred by seriously inaccurate estimates of the position by latitude and longitude of the High Seas Fleet. So, in essence, he's getting it wrong because they're moving.
Yeah, it's not his fault. He's trying his best. Now, then there's another disaster. It's another signalling calamity, like Calamity Jane was, you know. As the battlecruisers turn, the fifth battle squadron, you've got to imagine it, they've turned and they're now going to the north, but the fifth battle squadron, sorry, the battlecruiser turn, the fifth battle squadron is still heading to the south, and they're still firing at the German battlecruisers, and they're watching... Still watching the German destroyers that are still out. Remember we told you about the destroyer action.
Yeah, there's sort of melee going on between the lines,
cool.
Isn't there?
Very exciting that was, wasn't it?
Now, this is controversial, so we're going to glide by it.
Well, yeah, much as indeed the 5th Battle Squadron continued to glide towards the High Seas Fleet. What happens?
Well, at 16:48, as they came up to the point where they would pass the battlecruisers...
On opposite courses...
Beatty hoisted a flag order that was unambiguously directed at Evan Thomas.
He's on the Barham, isn't he?
Alter course in succession, 16 points to starboard.
Now, this was a bit unfortunate because he, instead of turning all at once, he says in succession, instead of turn together or whatever. Now, that wouldn't have been that important, but there was another fucking...
a serious breakdown.
Thank you, Gary.
In signals procedure, I think, is what you're struggling with.
If only the listeners could see me with my head hung in shame.
Now, flag signal only became executive in the sense that it should be carried out instantly, only after it had been acknowledged by the relevant subordinate admiral. And at the moment at which it was hauled down aboard the flagship.
Now, this was not, the signal to turn was not made executive at the ideal moment. That's so that the 5th Battle Squadron could swing round and one by one into the line behind the battle cruisers. It wasn't. And what does Evan Thomas do?
Well, for a second time that day, he chose to rely on correct naval signal procedure rather than use his common sense to turn before the formal executive order was issued.
Oh, now. I think he hasn't got a bloody leg to stand on here, has he? What does he think? Beatty wanted him to sail the four most valuable ships in the Navy right into the concentrated fire of the leading dreadnoughts of the high seas fleet to cover the retreat of the battlecruisers. What did he think was happening?
Well, they were super dreadnoughts.
Yeah.
But not that super.
No. I mean, it's ridiculous. So, Gary, for 4 or 5 minutes, the 5th Battle Squadron carries on racing to the south. And at the same time, remember, the High Seas Fleet is racing the other way. So you've got to realise how much of time is passing, the speed. It's just a bloody disaster. And you're going to be Lieutenant Patrick Brind, aboard HMS Malaya, one of the 5th Battle Squadron.
Up to this time, the shooting for us had been like a peace battle practice. I felt that according to all the rules of the game, the German battle cruisers ought not to remain much longer afloat if only the light held. I had not up to date thought much of the dangers of being hit by a projectile, except perhaps just before the action, when my mind did certainly wander on the gruesome prospects of a naval action. Now, however, matters took a different complexion. We were closing the High Seas Fleet at a rate of 40 knots, and there was every prospect of being engaged with them in a very short period of time. My feelings at that time are rather hard to analyse, for as things were then happening quite quickly, I had not much time for thinking whether I was frightened or not, but I dare say that if I had stopped to think, I should have been.
Yeah, and when he says 40 knots, does he mean they're going at 40? No, they're going at about 23, but the other side's going at about 20. So combined together, they're closing at a speed of 4. It's ridiculous.
Now, at last... Now, at last, around 1654, the offending signal was hauled down and thus made executive. Well, it's only then that the 5th Battle Squadron begins their delayed turn.
Now, didn't we say that was going to be in succession?
We did, which earlier that seemed merely overly fussy, but now it's extremely dangerous.
Well, because they're well within range now. Why is it so dangerous? Give me a technical explanation, which I'm sure you're up to.
Well, because the German 3rd Battle Squadron could concentrate their fire on the point at which the super dreadnoughts would all pass in their turn. True. Their spotting would be rendered difficult by the forest of splashes in such a small area, but on the other hand, their target was a static point in the ocean.
Right, well, let's go back to Lieutenant Patrick Brind aboard HMS Malaya. What does he say?
I must confess to a feeling of relief when I realised that we were to turn round, though not at it being done in succession. When it was the turn of the Malaya to turn, the turning point was a very hot corner, as of course the enemy had concentrated on that point. The shells pouring at a very rapid rate, and it is doubtful if we, the last ship in the line, could get through without at least a severe hammering. However, the captain decided that point by turning the ship early.
Independent thought and action, Gary.
When we had turned, or rather as I was turning my turret to the starboard side, I saw our battle cruisers who were proceeding northerly at full speed. They were already quite 8,000 yards ahead of us, engaging the German battle cruisers. I then realised that the four of us alone, Barham, Warspite, Valiant and Malaya, would have to entertain the High Seas Fleet.
Oh, it's lovely. Tea and cakes.
Some famous ships there.
Yeah, we love those ships, don't we? Now, that chap, we ought to mention his name, Captain Algernon Boyle. He got the Malaya through a terribly dangerous position. But she didn't get through without being hit at all. This is what Sub-Lieutenant Clifford Caslon says. He was on the Malaya, of course. He says this. We were hit twice, both times on the armour, with no damage. This was my first experience of being hit. The whole ship seemed to jar, but I didn't notice the noise of the explosion to any particular extent. One might compare the sensation to the feeling in one's arms if one takes a sledgehammer and brings it down as hard as possible on an anvil, keeping one's arms rigid. Well, many a time I've done that, Gary, and I've thought, this must be exactly what it feels like to be in a battleship when it's hit by a shell. Isn't that? That's the sort of reverse, I suppose.
Yeah, and you have many experiences of being hit, don't you?
Yes.
Now, although it had been a close-run thing, the 5th Battle Squadron had, for the moment, got away with their over-close exposure to the full force of their many enemies. Now, meanwhile, at 1643, Beatty had also ordered the recall of his destroyers from between the lines.
Yeah, yeah. That, and we're not going to go on anymore. I mean, a lot of these things are actually dramatic in the extreme. If you were to read my book, Jutland, you'll see the drama of those destroyers caught between the lines. But we haven't got time, have we, Gary? We've got to press on, is your cry.
Now, successive commanders in chiefs of the High Seas Fleet had schemed to isolate and destroy a significant section of the Grand Fleet. As the surviving battlecruisers and the super dreadnoughts of the Vice Admiral Sir David Beatty's battlecruiser fleet, that's a mouthful, began their run to the north, they represented the most glittering of prizes.
Glittering of prizes. Is that like the glitterati?
It is. Are you going to join in at all?
No, I just think you're so... You just seem to have a grip on everything that's going on. Anyway, all right. Now, Admiral Reinhard Scheer, he must have realised that there was a possibility that the Grand Fleet was out, but he's prepared to take the risk of an encounter to get this prize, this glittering prize, which is tantalisingly within the range of his big bangy things. What would happen if any of Beatty's ships were hit and in any way incapacitated?
Well, at that point, the High Seas Fleet would inevitably overhaul them and their destruction would surely be assured.
Oh, blimey. And at a stroke, thereby, the Germans would erode the measure of superiority that the Grand Fleet had. It would also do something else. What else would it do?
It had removed forever the myth of British invincibility and perhaps then allow a decisive confrontation on an equal footing.
Now, for the Germans, I think the overall result of the battle is going to be decided by this phase. What is it? If they could destroy Beatty's force without suffering serious losses themselves, then they'd have achieved their objectives, they'd have won the battle. Before Admiral Sir John Jellicoe could get the mighty Grand Fleet into action. Well, they've already done well. What about the sinking of the Indefatigable and Queen Mary during the run to the south?
Well, that's at least a very good start, isn't it? But it was not nearly enough to tip the naval balance of power towards the Germans. For Beatty, this phase of the battle was merely concerned with survival while he lured the High Seas Fleet into Jellicoe's grasp. And so, with the Germans apparently in control, an intriguing passage of the battle began.
So what we've got is we've got the 5th Battle Squadron, are steaming north. They're following Beatty's battlecruisers. And behind them, come the 3rd Battle Squadron of the High Seas Fleet. Then the rest of them. So there we have it. Let's name them again. The Barham, the Valiant, the Warspite, and the Malaya. They're being battered to buggery by the concentration of fire from the guns of the leading German dreadnoughts. And they've got a long way to go before they're going to meet up with the Grand Fleet.
Going to tell us what Commander Humphrey Walwyn of HMS Warspite says.
Very soon after the turn, I suddenly saw on the starboard quarter the whole of the High Seas Fleet. I saw masts, funnels, and an endless ripple of orange flashes all down the line. How many I didn't try and count as we were getting well strafed at this time. Wow.
Now, under this concentration of fire, the Barham was beginning to take a fair amount of punishment, with 3 hits being recorded within the 6 minutes between 1656 and 1702.
That's 3 big 12-inch shells smashing home, or more, actually, because this is what Lieutenant Commander Stephen Tillard on the HMS Barham says.
I saw all 4 rounds of the salvo, which hit Barham in midair as they came. One hit penetrated the deck 6 feet from where I stood. It went on to explode below without doing much harm. Another hit below the waterline and blew a hole in the opposite side of the ship, causing jagged edges which may have slowed us up. It wiped out a torpedo detachment.
That's just a bit of coldness about that, isn't it? Now, 1652, Admiral Franz von Hipper, he's also executed his own 16-point turn in succession. And so he's now steering north as well. He's 7 miles ahead of Scheer. So the first scouting group, they're firing at the four British battlecruisers, with each ship aiming at its opposite number in the line. While the the von der Tann, which is already in a terrible state from the battering by the 5th Battle Squadron, is bringing up its rear. How many guns has it got left?
It's got one operational 11-inch turret.
Yeah, so two bangy things. And it's aiming at the Malaya of the 5th Battle Squadron. How would you describe the condition of the German battlecruisers at this time, Gary, using technical terms if possible?
Well, they were beginning to fray at the edges under the accumulated weight of hits they'd suffered.
Yeah. Now, the visibility, any better on the run to the south?
No. Well, if anything, it's worse.
No, yeah, that's right, yeah. And the British return fire from the battlecruisers is pretty poor. It's generally ineffective. Now, 1701, Beatty reacts to this renewed pressure on his battlecruisers. What does he do?
Conscious that his first duty was to draw the Germans towards Jellicoe rather than engage in an irrelevant firefight, in which he'd be at a disadvantage, he decided to minimise the risk during the run north.
Yeah, sensible. This is sensible, isn't it?
Yeah, he ordered a turn away onto a northwesterly course, which naturally had the effect of opening out the range, and from 1708, the firing between the rival battlecruisers gradually dies down.
Yeah, at the same time, he orders Vice Admiral Hugh Evan Thomas to prolong the line by taking station astern. But there's 4,000 yards by this time between the leading Barham and the New Zealand that's at the arse end of the battlecruisers. How fast the battlecruisers going, Gary?
Well, they're making about 25 knots in contrast to the 23.5 that could be achieved by the super dreadnoughts. So this gap was opening all the time.
But they're not closing, it's getting worse. Now, Beatty would have had to cut his speed below 24 knots to allow them to have any chance of catching up. Did he do that?
No, he didn't do it, and thus, in effect, the 5th Battle Squadron were left to act as a powerful rear guard for the battlecruisers.
Now, they split their fire. The Barham and the Valiant, they fire at their German battlecruisers. The Warspite and the Malaya are behind them, and they aim at the leading German battle squadrons of the 3rd Battle Squadron, the Dreadnoughts. Do you know what? It's a pretty fraught situation. There's a lot of pressure on them. But how do the super dreadnoughts do? There's a reason they're called super dreadnoughts.
Well, they certainly demonstrate the sting that they carried in their collective towel, didn't they? Several hits were scored on the now struggling Seydlitz. One shell hit the Lutzow, and other shells crashed into the leading German dreadnoughts, the Grosser Kurfürst and Mark Graf.
Glad you said all that.
Now, both sides were now exchanging hammer blows. And
yeah.
Once more, you're going to tell us what Commander Humphrey Waugh in the bald HMS Warspite says.
The noise of their shells over and short was deafening. That frightful crack, crack, crack going all the time. Felt one or two very heavy shakes, but didn't think very much of it at the time. And it never occurred to me that we were being hit. We were firing pretty fast at green 120. No idea what that means. It's the direction it means. I distinctly saw two of our salvos hit the leading German battleship. Sheets of yellow flames went right over her mastheads, and she looked red fore and aft like a burning haystack. I know we hit her hard. Told everybody in the turret that we were doing all right and to keep going. Machinery working like clockwork mouse, and no hang-up of any sort whatsoever.
Now, after that excitement, we'll just take a short break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Whatever the imagined maximum speed of the 5th Battle Squadron, it was clear that they could not shake off the German Koenig-class dreadnoughts that made up the 3rd Battle Squadron.
Yeah, they're slowly clawing themselves into range, in fact. So if anything, it's going the other way. And as the German battleships get closer, so the amount of fire that are directed at the rear couple of ships, it increases exponentially. And you're going to say what Lieutenant Patrick Brind, now an old favourite of us on HMS Malaya, says.
Their salvos began to arrive thick and fast. From my position in the turret, I could see them fall just short, could hear them going just over, and several times saw a great column of black water fall on the top of the turret roof. I expected at any moment we should get a nasty knock, and I realised that if any one of those many shells falling round us should hit us in the right place, our speed would be sadly reduced, and that we should not then stand a very good chance. The salvos at the time were coming at a rate of 6 to 9 a minute.
Wow. Now, at this point, Shears really gets excited. At 17:19, he issues the orders, which are in German. You'll perhaps translate this into German for us so we get the feel of it. He issues the order, throwing caution to the winds, pursue the enemy, which is, Gary?
Chase the enemy.
I want you to translate it into German.
No, that's what it means.
Thank you, Gary.
That's all right, mate. Now, the Malaya, as the hindmost ship, was in severe danger, and to some extent, her continued survival depended purely on luck.
Yep, any hit that slowed her speed by anything almost, and she'd face obliteration. My mind is fluttering to the situation. I've seen sink the Bismarck a couple of times recently. You know, the whole thing was, could they slow her down? If they slow her down, doomed.
Yeah. I mean, the Malaya's armour would not be able to protect her against the kind of close-range battering she would inevitably receive if the entire high seas fleet overhauled her.
Ah, but she was lucky, wasn't she? And this is what Sub-Lieutenant Clifford Casland says, who was aboard the Malaya. Malaya was at first very lucky, and although shells were falling all around and the ship deluged in spray, she wasn't hit much. During this time, the range was still too great, about 18,000 yards, for my 6-inch guns to be in action, and I remained a spectator. It was extraordinarily fascinating. The visibility was bad and it was difficult to see the German battleships distinctly, but one could see the flashes of their guns, and then after an interval of 30 seconds, the salvos would fall round the ship. During this period, we never had less than 3 ships firing at us, and sometimes more. Wow, wow, wow!
Now, her luck could not, and actually did not, last. From 1720, the Malaya received serious hits abreast on her B and X turrets.
Ooh. Then, 1730, she gets a really bad hit, a dreadful hit, on the starboard 6-inch battery. And the consequences are just dreadful. This is a horrible bit of this podcast coming up. I hope you'll realise that this is just not funny. You're going to tell what happened. Private John Harris, the Royal Marine Light Infantry, a Marine, wore the Malaya, and he describes what happens, or starts to describe it.
A German battleship took up position on our right and let us have it broadside with everything she had. Shells ripped through the armour plating like a knife through cheese. One shell dropped amidships, came down through the deckhead and exploded. It ignited our ammunition charges, throwing every man off his feet. We lay half stunned until the dreaded cry, "Fire!" It was soon roaring like a furnace and we were trapped by watertight doors.
Now, the shell had hit on the number three gun. It had killed all the crew and it, as he said, John Harris said, it ignited the cordite that had been put on trolleys at the rear of the guns by the ammunition party. It's actually a bit like, you know, when we were on board HMS Victory. It's actually not, the six-inch gun battery is not that dissimilar, except there's a wall behind it, if you see what I mean. Now, the flash fire, what happens to it?
Well, it's swept from end to end of the starboard battery and it causes severe casualties. And once more, you're going to tell us what Sub-Lieutenant Clifford Caslam aboard the Malaya says.
Yeah, he's in the gun control tower and he says, the tower was filled with fumes and blue smoke and we were knocked backwards, but it cleared immediately and there was no damage. Suter, that's one of the other officers, again called down from the foretop to know if I was all right. And I told him, yes. I put my face to the battery voice pipe to inquire for them. But there was no need to ask. I could hear the most terrible pandemonium and the groans and cries of wounded men. I heard one man call out, "Walter, we're burning." Another chilling memory of a Second World War film, which people have seen, is Compass Rose, where something very similar happens with the voice pipe shouting down to doomed men. Oh, awful. So,
now, in these desperate circumstances, Caslam was given permission to go down and see what he could do to help. But reaching the scene of the fire proved easier said than done. And this is Sub-Lieutenant Clifford Caslam once more.
The only way down was a ladder that led into the port battery. And on arrival there, I found that all the lights out and a crowd of men were having difficulty joining up a hose to the fire main. This was soon put right. And then a petty officer said that the door at the forward end, dividing the port battery from the starboard, was jammed. In the meantime, the lieutenant and midshipman of the port battery went to the dividing door at the after end of the part of the battery with a party to try and get a hose in that way. Well, they've got no time to lose. And Caslon, he's a bright lad. He decides to back his own brain, back a hunch. And he says this, "I felt sure that the forward door was not jammed as it was much too heavy. So went forward to see. And as I had expected, found they had missed one of the clips in the darkness." This is the panic and confusion, isn't it, Gary? "While I was knocking this back, the men with the hose just behind me were playing it all over me. And I remember very distinctly using bad language at them about it." I only mention this because when the door swung open, a big sheet of flame came through. And the fact of me being wet probably saved me from being nastily burned. Immediately afterwards, this is the terrible bit, five blackened figures rushed out. They were the survivors from number one gun. Yeah.
Now, the mental anguish and corresponding relief of those men, seemingly doomed to the most horrible of deaths, only to be reprieved at the very last moment, can barely be imagined.
Yeah, I can't imagine it. But it's not over for those men, and we'll be coming back to this. Speed is of the essence. If you've got that level of burns, if they're going to be saved, they've also got to put the fire out, and they've got to see they're in battle. They've got to see if any of the 6-inch guns are still serviceable, and if they can find crews to man them. Well,
the aftermath of the fire as the casualties and corpses were brought out was stomach churning, and this is wireless telegraphist Frederick Arnold, again aboard the Malaya. "We in the wireless office could see the first aid parties passing our door, going to the aft deck carrying bodies and wounded, laying them out and treating, where possible, the badly burned and shot cases. Some of the dead were so burned and mutilated as to be unidentifiable. The living, badly burned cases were almost encased in wrappings of cotton wool and bandages with just slits for their eyes to see through. In fact, the few walking cases who could wander about the after deck presented a grim, weird and ghoulish sight."
Oh, it's terrible. And down below is a narrow inner passage below decks. It's just a corridor passage, sorry, yeah. Surgeon Lieutenant Duncan Lorimer, he's got the aft distribution station and he's with his medical party. And a lot of the burn cases are brought to him. And, you know, there's just bugger all he can do but look on as they suffer. And this is the most awful quote we've had for a while from Surgeon Lieutenant Duncan Lorimer, HMS Malaya.
"A man will walk into the dressing station or possibly be carried in with face and hands badly scorched, not deeply burned or disfigured. One would call it a burn of the first degree. Very rapidly, almost as one looks, the face swells up. The looser parts of the skin become enormously swollen. The eyes are invisible through the great swelling of the lids. The lips, enormous jelly-like masses, in the centre of which a button-like mouth appears. I have an idea that it must be due to the very high temperature of the burning cordite applied for a very short time. It is quite unlike any burns I've ever seen in civil life and would be very easily avoided by wearing asbestos gloves and masks or similar anti-fire substance. The great cry is water, not much pain, and that is easily subdued by morphia. There is then great and increasing restlessness, breathing rapid and shallow, and final collapse. The bodies stiffen in their twisted attitudes very rapidly. The scorched areas are confined to the exposed parts, face, head and hands, hair, beard and eyebrows burn off. The skin of the hands, the whole epidermis, including the nails, peels off like a glove. In many cases, one has to look twice to be certain that one is cutting off only skin and not the whole finger. In very few cases does the burning appear to go any deeper than this, and yet they die and die very rapidly. Cases, looking quite slight at first, become rapidly worse and die in an appallingly short time. It is possible in such circumstances to try many remedies. Stimulants, such as spirits and strychnine, were useless. We had no time to transfuse. Whether it would have done any good, I don't know. I doubt it. The end came so rapidly in many cases. Brandy, hot bottles and drinks, with, of course, the dressing of the cases and some operations were the utmost we could do.
There's some interesting points in that. One, it's as a result of this battle. If you ever see pictures of HMS Belfast, they bring in the asbestos clothing, the hoods and the gloves. The other thing is transfusion means, I presume that's blood transfusions, yeah. I found that quite depressing. Anyway, just ahead of the Malaya, there's another ship. Who's the one in front of that?
Well, the Warspite, and she'd also been hit by a salvo of shells that crashed down onto the quarterdeck at her ex-turret at around 1730. Commander Walwyn was ordered by the captain to go aft and see what was happening. And yes, you're going to once more tell us what Commander Humphrey Walwyn sees.
I thought for a few seconds, I like this, should I go over the top of the turret or down through the shell room? I.e. safe or not safe. Not safe or safe. But I realised I ought to get there quickly and decided to go over the top. I didn't waste much time on the roof as the noise was awful and the shells were coming over pretty quick. As I got down the starboard ladder of B turret, both A and B fired and made me skip a little bit quicker. Ran down ladder and tried to get into port superstructure. All clips were on, so I climbed over second cutter. Just as I got up, one came through the after funnel with an awful screech and splattered about everywhere. I put up my coat collar and ran like a stag, feeling in a hell of a funk. I just put up my collar. Oh, dear.
Now, at first, he couldn't find anything wrong, despite searching through the mess decks. Then he actually saw a shell hit.
Went through the forecastle mess deck and was just going forward when a 12-inch came through the side armour on the boys' mess deck. Terrific sheet of golden flame, stink, impenetrable dust, and everything seemed to fall everywhere with an appalling noise. Wow.
Now, Walwyn swings into action, organising...
He's the executive officer. I should have said that, yeah.
He swings into action to... Don't worry about interrupting me, please.
I'm not going to interrupt.
Organising the various damage control parties, because, as you mentioned earlier, speed was essential.
It was.
The severed fire mains allowed thousands of gallons of water to flood the decks below X turret with awful consequences for one trapped sailor. And this is able seaman gunner Percival Cox aboard the Warspite. The working chamber was flooded. A shell had severed the 4-inch fire main and water was pouring into the handling room. I reported this to the gunhouse. They soon had it under control, but the sentry was in charge of the escape hatch was drowned.
I think that's just awful, don't you? That's their own water. That's not the sea.
No. And unsurprisingly, Walwyn at last was forced to pause to catch his breath. And you're going to be once more Commander Humphrey
Walwyn. I like the sound of Humphrey Walwyn. Had a cigarette on the port side of the cook's lobby. A rather started one to steady my feelings. Had a yarn with a pay officer who was wandering about in a kapok waistcoat using appalling language as to when the Grand Fleet was going to turn up. Had a laugh together anyway. Whilst there, a 12-inch shell came into the warrant officer's galley and blew through the deck. A stoker alongside me looked and said, "There goes my fucking dinner."
Now, despite all the alarms and hits, yeah, I see what you've done there, Pete. It won't be meaning to anybody yet. The second distinct phase of the Battle of Jutland, subsequently known as the Run to the North, was characterised by the almost miraculous survival of the 5th Battle Squadron.
I think so. It is amazing to me that these four ships survived. And they're not just victims, are they? They're not. So they're really, really. They're trials and tribulations that would depress anyone. But what are the Bar and the Valiant and Warspite Malaya doing?
Well, they're distinguishing themselves through the prowess of their magnificent gunnery as they continue to score repeated hits on the German ships that threaten them.
And what do you think of repeated hits by 15-inch shells does to a ship?
A technical term?
Yeah.
Buggers it. Now, the Seydlitz was systematically battered.
Buggered.
As were the Lutzow and the Derfflinger. All of these battle cruisers felt the crushing weight of the huge British 15-inch shells.
Now, think about it, Gary. So what the Germans had high expectations. Scheer must have, von Hipper. The run to the south, this is their moment. How do you think they felt?
Well, it must have been deeply disappointing for them.
Yeah.
And this is what Commander George von Hess of SMS Derfflinger of
the 1st Scouting Group. Listeners, don't listen.
But except I can't remember if he's Richthofen or Hoare.
He's Richthofen.
Oh, okay. This part of the action fought against a numerically inferior but more powerfully armed enemy who kept us under fire at ranges at which we were helpless was highly depressing, nerve-wracking and exasperating. Our only means of defence was to leave the line for a short time when we saw that the enemy had our range. As this manoeuvre was imperceptible to the enemy, we extricated ourselves at regular intervals from the hail of fire.
And he sums it up because, I mean, I like von Hess, he's a great character, but the long ranges they're firing at, they're a bit beyond their 12 and 11-inch guns, the visibility's not good, drifting smoke, that reduces the effectiveness of the battlecruiser, German battlecruiser fire, doesn't it? So let's move towards a summary of this phase. How are you going to start?
Well, in the event, neither side suffered the kind of disaster that might have been expected.
Yeah, the heavy armour of the super dreadnoughts did prevent the kind of damage which might have reduced their speed or combat efficiency. The armour of the German battlecruisers, well, how about that?
Well, it couldn't prevent severe damage from the 15-inch shells that severely eroded their fighting powers, but it proved sound enough to protect their vitals. Now, in summary, Scheer did not succeed in significantly reducing the strength of the Grand Fleet. That was his stated objective.
That was the purpose of his sortie into the North Sea, to entrap and destroy a significant portion of the British fleet. He'd had his chance, but through the resilience of the super dreadnoughts, it slipped through his fingers. What would you say at the end of this phase? What would you say is there a sea change, to use an expression?
Well, Scheer's period of ascendancy had passed. There was no clear victor in the run to the north, except perhaps for the man who lurked over the horizon. Jellicoe's long-awaited moment was approaching.
Jellicoe, what's going to happen, Gary? What?
You'll have to tune in to find out.
Or buy Jutland by Peter Hart and Nigel Steele. It's all in there.
Cheers, Pete.
Cheers, Gary. Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?